You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows on our website, castaway.media.
Welcome to the Retro Asylum.
I am the Night Rider. I'm a fuel-injected suicide machine.
I am a rocker. I'm a roller. I'm a controller.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Retro Asylum, episode 131. I'm Matt Lamborn and with me is Paul Driscoll, a.k.a. The Drisk. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm fine, mate. How's yourself?
Doing pretty good. It's been a very busy couple of weeks for everyone concerned, but looking forward to getting into a good bit of conversation about vehicular warfare games, something that I don't think we've covered before, which would be quite interesting.
Yeah.
So, I must say, some of my favourite games ever involve like car combat. If you think back to some of the real classics of yesteryear, a lot of really popular games have circled around, so if you think of stuff like Chase HQ and Spy Hunter and stuff like that. This is one of those particular genres that has been with us since the beginning, and it's probably not one that necessarily comes to mind as an obvious genre when people think about these type of things. So I think it'll be an interesting one for us to cover, and hopefully our audience have played most of these. If you haven't, you might find a hidden gem or two that you can go out and try.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, as I say, I've had a lot of fun with some of these because, as I say, some I knew really well, but it was just great coming back to it. And others, as I say, was a definitely brand new. yeah, a lot of fun.
Good stuff. I think it's fair to say that at least some of these are marginally debatable in terms of quality, but there are definitely some of them on the list which would rank amongst some of the most popular games of all time. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to definitely find something in the treasure chest for everyone who's listening. At least one or two of these will rank very highly amongst your favourite games. So before we get into that, though, we're going to have a little chat about what we've been up to and anything that we've been buying recently. So has there been anything on your shopping list that you've managed to acquire lately,
Mr. Driscoll? I've sort of been overspending at the beginning of the month. I've still been building up my Bitmap Brothers collection, collection. I really want to sort of build it up, but then I found out from talking to someone in the know that the Chaos Engine 2, apparently they only sold 4,000 copies.
Whoa.
And the rest they buried somewhere, so I really want to find out where they buried it. Perhaps do like a, you know, like they did on the ET, although it'd be bit more soggier in the UK, won't it? But
with all the rain, but disaster. 4,000 copies, wow.
Yeah, so but of course what that means is if I truly want every Bitmap Brothers game, which was my original plan, thinking, oh well, that's going to be a nice, you know, relatively easy thing to collect up, to have a complete set. Well, it's immediately put a dampener in the works because that means Chaos Engine 2 is going to be really expensive.
Wow.
So I think I've already set my sights just to the ones I like, because there's no point getting it just to complete the set, really, because I don't even like the game.
You know there is.
I know. Well, it's that, you know, the one that I shouted out, I think it was on the Halloween one, with a Nintendo Quest. Documentary. That's got me to want the completest bug. You know, I got the completest bug from it. You know, and that's where I was thinking, well, what can I get that's, you know, build up over time that will be the complete set of something? Mm-hmm. And that's where I hit on Bitmap Brothers. But I'm also hoping to sort of collect up and build up my CD32 collection.
Very nice.
Yeah, but apart from that, as I say, I haven't been doing too much because we've been doing podcasts all the time, it feels, isn't it, really?
Yeah, we're staying on good form at the minute and keeping them coming, and the quality remains high, so that's good.
Yeah, but one thing I did find out which I've got to shout out to everybody, because I've been asking around, haven't I, with the other Retro Asylum hosts, just in case it was obvious, and I just didn't happen to know it. But I was in the local retro game shop in GameSmart in Yardley, my local retro game shop, and I was talking to Josh, who works there, and he was saying, oh yeah, well of course, you know, the PS3 can run PS1 games. And I'm like, I sort of came back and said, no, well, I think that was only the first model, you know, with the four USB ports, you know, because that had the PS2 built in it. And he goes, no, no, it's any PS3. And I have to admit, I didn't believe him. But he got to the point where he got a PS3 and put it on and showed me firsthand. And I've tried it at home. I've got a PS3 Super Slim, the second model. Mm-hmm. You know, the 1 terabyte,
yeah.
And yeah, any PS1 game works absolutely fine, and that's huge for me. I mean, playing on a wireless, you know, the wireless PS3 controller, they look great as well, because it's going through the, you know, the HDMI. I mean, it's still a PS1 game, but it still looks impressive. Yeah, some of the games that we're going to be talking about look so good, you know, running through the PS3. I tried it on the PS1 as well to make sure, because you can't beat the original hardware. But it's, yeah, absolutely great. So it was a major find, and I was amazed that it seems to be quite a well-kept secret. I mean, I'm sure probably a lot of our listeners probably already know it, but certainly within the hosts and the people I asked outside didn't seem to know that feature.
I think it's just lost knowledge. I think that Sony touted the backwards compatibility features of the PS3 a lot as a key feature when it first came out, but people just moved on so quickly that it just ceased to be relevant. And then with Sony taking out the emotion chip for the later models of the PS3, so it couldn't emulate PS2, which is probably the most popular console of all time, everyone just forgot about it and moved on. I myself picked up a boxed original PS3 a couple of months ago in pristine condition, and it's the 40 gig model with the four USB ports, so I can play everything. It's such a great hassle saver from not having to dig out various different consoles. I can just play all through one through HDMI, which is great. And if you're a bit of an audiophile, the original PS3 has also had super audio CD capabilities as well, so it definitely has its uses. So yeah, definitely a good thing to try and pick up before they start getting too expensive.
So how about yourself? What have you been up to?
I've had a few additions to the collection, both retro and current. Just today, as a matter of fact, I picked up the King of Fighters 94 for the Neo Geo CD, which I don't own a Neo Geo CD console, but I actually really love the soundtrack on this game, and you can just play the disc as a soundtrack in a normal CD player, which is great. So I'm probably just going to use it for that until I eventually do get a Neo Geo CD. But it's my favourite King of Fighters game, so delighted to get that. I got it really cheap, and it's sealed too, which is always nice.
Oh, wow.
In the last couple of weeks, I've also added to my Super Famicom collection. Now, I went on a bit of a splurge at Play Manchester, picking up some Japanese Super Famicom stuff. And I'm not into buying games at any price type of thing. I'm quite happy to take my time and try and pick off the deals as and when they come up. So I managed to get some for like a £5 to £10 range. And I got all Japanese. I got Super Mario RPG, Mario All-Stars, which is known as the Mario Collection in Japan. And I also got a Chamakai Mura, which is the Japanese version of Ghouls and Ghosts.
Oh, cool.
Which I was delighted by.
Yeah.
I hate the box art on the PAL and US versions. It's an abomination.
Oh, the Japanese box art sound good in most cases.
So I was delighted to get that. I paid a bit more for that one. That was £20, but the guy was trying to sell it for £35, and I managed to talk him down a bit. So that was good. So really pleased with those.
Awesome.
I think I'm probably done now until New Year.
Is that you deciding that with the missus?
No, it's me. Start to get buyer's remorse when I get too many things at the same time. So I think I'll keep quiet on eBay now until in the new year and reassess the situation then, or maybe wait until another expo or something comes up and can almost go on a spending spree there, a bit more justified than doing it online.
This is Nancy at Chase headquarters. We have an emergency here. Carlos, the New York armed robber, has been seen listening to Retro Asylum without leaving a review on iTunes. Over.
Leave it to us, Nancy, baby. Let's go, Mr. Driver. If you really enjoy the Retro Asylum podcast show, then please leave us a review on iTunes.
So without further ado, I think it's time to rev up your engines, attach your gun turrets and get those oil slick canisters ready, because we're going into the deep end of vehicular warfare.
It's glad you're the one saying the V. I can't. That's definitely going to be a word I'm going to stumble over. Vehicular warfare.
That's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah, okay, so what's the first game we're going to cover then?
Okay, so the first one, it's an all-time great, and it was arguably the PS1's killer app, particularly for the European launch. And of course we're talking about the almighty Wipeout. Now, Wipeout in itself managed to strike a chord with an audience that wasn't necessarily a traditional gaming fan. It appealed to a far more unique market. You know, it was aimed at nightclubbers and ravers. Yeah. And there was something intangibly cool about Wipeout, and it certainly wasn't necessarily aimed at young children, although it certainly would appeal to those as well. But it definitely had a more adult or young adult slant on it, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. I remember the first time I ever saw it, actually, was... Do you remember a game... a film called Hackers?
Of course!
Yeah. I love that film. And, of course, it looked nothing like it when it...
Yeah,
really,
the high-res prototype, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a high-res prototype. But I mean, that was the first time seeing... I would love if they did turn that into a real arcade.
They probably could now, because there was no way at the time that particular Wipeout would have been possible.
Yeah. Well, I suppose...
available. But now it could do.
Well, I suppose we've almost got it, haven't we, with the old Wipeout HD. But I suppose we're going ahead of ourselves. But it's... I love this series. One of my favourite sort of series. I mean, I love your F-Zeros and things, but Wipeout did something different. And they say it was really ahead of its time. Just had those amazing, 11 songs, and they were all sort of dance hits. You know, you got your Prodigy and Future Sound of London and the Chemical Brothers. I mean, they really were the coolest bands.
They were the real counterculture underground.
We flagged in the last episode with Bitmap Brothers that, of course, you know, the Bitmap Brothers sort of got there first in doing underground hits. But, of course, now you have CD and true technology to be able to sort of do these sort of tunes. And I suppose one of the other things that was very, very cool with it was they got the Designer Republic, didn't they, to do the sort of that cool futuristic graphic design.
Yeah,
you know,
it's just a very unique
iconic
flavor,
yeah.
Iconic look about it. Yeah,
yeah, and I find it amazing that it was actually the idea of the game came up in another pub, and I was reading in an interview that I think it was in Retro Asylum actually, that they even said the name of the pub, which was in the Shrewsbury Arms. In Oxton, Birkenhead, and I was actually looking, and the pub still exists, and it looks quite a nice pub. So I'm reckoning that one time we need to do a sort of like a pub road trip, going to like the places where Speedball was conceived, and go to the pub that Wipeout was conceived, and work our way through. We have to find out others that are, other games that were conceived in pubs as well.
Hopefully that particular pub's got a nice fridge full of Red Bull, because that's the kind of audience we're dealing with here, rather than pint swiggers.
Yeah.
Definitely into energy drink territory with Wipeout. And I think, actually, Wipeout was one of the first places that you could actually see a advert for Red Bull in the series. I don't know if it was in the first game, but definitely in one of the sequels, many years before it became really, really popular.
Yeah, well,
drinking it.
I was fascinated because obviously, like, checking various games and interviews that people had done and what have you, and reviews that people had done. And there was one American review for the sequel, which is, of course, they know it as Wipeout XL. We know it as 2097. And they were saying that at the time that Red Bull was being advertised, energy drinks were illegal, from what he was saying, in America. You know, hadn't passed the approval, the Food Association approval. So he didn't know what it was at that time. But of course, we knew it really well in Europe and other parts of the world. I mean, and again, it was part of that sort of like club culture. I mean, I pretty much lived back in the day on you know, vodka and Red Bull. That was the go-to drink. So yeah, but I suppose back to the game itself, because we decided, didn't we, to cover more on the sequel.
I must admit, I really liked the first game, but 2097 was definitely my favourite of the series, and definitely the one I spent the most time on.
Yeah.
And we probably also had my favourite soundtrack of the series as well. I mean, they're all good. But I was a massive Prodigy fan back at this period of time. And how they managed to get that instrumental of Firestarter when the Prodigy really were probably the biggest thing on the planet at the time. Such a coup.
Yeah.
But it suited the game perfectly on the rush of adrenaline you get when you're flying that anti-gravity vehicle down the courses and to pumping hard to Firestarter. Absolutely perfect blend of style and substance on equal measure. It was a dream.
But I suppose we ought to actually, because there might be the odd person out there who's never played the game, so I suppose ought to describe it. It's basically, isn't it? It's a hover futuristic racer, so you're actually floating above the track. So if you sort of imagine running on magnets or whatever, and then you're anti-grav, and then you're basically riding over these tracks at really fast speeds. But it has elements of almost like Mario Kart, where you can pick up weapons. So there was what did you have? You had weapons and speed up icons. So
yeah,
there's
so
speed up
like force fields, homing missiles, and all very colourful as well. It's not just a normal fiery effect. They're all multicoloured again, neon, a call back to that clubland culture again. And you also add like speed tiles that you can run over. So it's very similar to sort of kart racing in terms of those who are familiar with that particular genre. You go over these tiles, you get a special ability, and they're dotted around the track. So memorising not only where the corners are, but where these tiles are going to be laid out on the track is essential, because you need to hit as many of them as possible to stay as far up the field as you can.
And that's the trick, isn't it, with this? The first thing you have to master is the air brakes. So the on the PS1 controller, you've got the trigger buttons, isn't it? And that is crucial to be able to master using those air brakes to help you round the corners, keep high speeds. But you're absolutely right. It's all about knowing that track inside out. I mean, I always remember, particularly on Wipeout 2097, just continually doing the track up, you know, again and again, just to learn it inside out, where it was almost instinctive, so you knew every sort of speed up icon. Just to, and that's probably the beauty of the game, because there isn't many tracks on either Wipeout, the first one or the second one. I mean, I think the second one had 6 tracks that were open and 2 hidden. So it wasn't really, I mean, it was quite a fair number for the time, but not, you know, by today's standard, there wasn't too many tracks there.
No, they managed to pack a fair amount into a box standard CD, particularly when you take into consideration the amount of audio on there as well. So managing to cram in all those 3D effects and tracks that they built up, I think they did a really good job. And weaponry, again, just going back to that, you remember the Quake Disruptor weapon, which
that was my favorite.
Down the tracks.
That was such a cool effect, wasn't it? Earthquake, hence the name, you know, Quake Disruptor.
Yeah.
And it would just rise up the track, wouldn't it? And just take out the opponent ahead.
Yeah, slightly overpowered, let's say, but not at all unlike a little nightclub trip.
But I'm surprised you said that the second one was your favorite. Because have you ever played the Wipeout 3 Special Edition?
No, I haven't. So I say I played the first one and the second one loads, and then it sort of tailed off me experience-wise.
Well, a useful tip, the Wipeout 3 Special Edition, which is really expensive to buy on its own, to be honest, but you can get, like, there was double packs with Destruction Derby, and I think they also did a double pack with another game. I've got the Destruction Derby. You can pick that up quite cheap, because people tend not to like the double packs, you know, collectors. The beauty of Wipeout 3 Special Edition is it was the Wipeout 3 game, plus it had 3 tracks from the first Wipeout, but using the Wipeout 3 engine, and five tracks from the 2097 game. So you've basically got the best tracks of the first three games on the one system. And a lot of people don't know with that. So it's a really useful tip if you're fans of the original, you know, the original PS1 series, then that's definitely the one to go for.
Cool, that's a great tip.
Yeah, of course, I do love the ones that came after. I mean, I've got every Wipeout game, so I've got the Fusion that came out on that was a PS2 launch title, and Pulse, which a lot of people don't know about. It was sort of based on the PSP Wipeout, but they did do quite a late PS2 release. Called,
do you think interest in the series was kind of waning by the time we got to sort of PS2?
Not for me.
I don't remember a lot of people really playing them at all. But...
Yeah, no, I mean, it was. People had sort of, you know, they'd lost interest. Because they are, in many ways, they are very inaccessible games that in regards to the difficulty level. It's one of those you really need to master the tracks to get anywhere in it. And it does get disheartening. I've seen a lot of people, that you know, friends of mine play it, where they just give up because... You know, they sort of try it. They end up last position for the first few tracks, and you know that's the first one they're racing on, and they think, you know, I'm just so bad at this, I don't want to play it anymore.
That's a bit of a shame.
Which is a shame. I must admit, though, out of because I also picked up on the PS3, which only came out in Europe as a you know, physical copy, but Wipeout HD and Wipeout Fury, it's like a double pack. And because we were playing the original games and I was getting all back into Wipeout, and I was so glad because it got me to put in the HD, you know, Wipeout HD on the PS3 and that, and give that a go. And it's such a good version, well worth picking up that double pack. And I feel really sorry to our American listeners that because I was talking to Alex, and apparently that never ever came out. I think digitally it came out, but never the physical copy.
It's strange, isn't it, how a game that popular can't make it into the biggest market for whatever reason. It's quite strange. But it's interesting that you mention about the PS3 and its enhanced graphics for the HD version and what. But I think Wipeout, even the original, and particularly the sequel, still stands out from its peers, you know, similar games that came out around the same time. It still looks really good compared to other early 3D games, some of which we're going to cover a bit later on.
I mean, even now, putting it on, it was like, I was convinced, because I first put it on the PS3, I was thinking, this is upscaling it. This is doing, you know, because it can't, surely it can't look that good.
Yeah.
And I put it on the original PS1. And it was like, no, actually, this game still looks darn good. It really is.
Compared to a lot amazing. Of other 3D PlayStation games that came out close to launch or even the first year or two, a lot of them suffered a lot from bad draw distances and bad clipping. Wipeout doesn't. You know, it's really well programmed. It's a really good showcase of what PlayStation can do. The developer sits down and really does a good job of it.
Yeah. And... yeah, definitely. I mean, and to be fair, the I've also got them on the Saturn. It's not as good as the PlayStation, but you know, they're pretty half decent versions, really. To be fair, on the Saturn as well.
Yeah, and that's another quirky thing as well, that it came out on the N64 and the Saturn, despite Psygnosis being a primarily Sony developer by that point. They were owned by Sony, I think, at that time.
Yeah, I think they had it written in the contract that it's a bit like how Rare could initially do games for other platforms, you know, for so many years or something like that. So that's how they sort of got away with it. But yeah, because it is strange that how they were sort of able to do that. Actually, the Wipeout on this 64 isn't too bad, if I seem to remember.
It's not bad at all, but what it does lack is that CD quality soundtrack.
Oh yeah,
which adds so much style to the game in general. But overall, that's a reasonable version. And I think even today, Wipeout is still very playable, very enjoyable. And it's a perfect example of how style can complement substance, and the two become a greater sum than the individual parts. It's a perfect package.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you think it's almost like 20 years old, the sequel. That's the sequel. The original is 20 years old because that was a PlayStation, a launch title.
You're making me feel very old
for Europe, at least. I know. It always depresses me. I get so depressed when people actually say with these consoles, because it's like, surely it wasn't that long ago.
Hi, this is Jeff Minter, and you're not listening to one of my sheep. You're listening to Retro Asylum.
Okay, so I think we'll move on to our next game, and we're going to go back a little bit further in time to the 16-bit era. A game that, at least in its first incarnation, got a release on a lot of different platforms, although the sequel was pretty much a Mega Drive exclusive. And of course, we're talking about Road Rash.
Ah, yes.
It's easily one of the coolest and most unique races of its day, guaranteed.
Definitely.
For those who somehow have been living under a rock and never played a Road Rash game, it combines motorcycle racing with an almost side-scrolling beat-em-up-esque combat system. So all the people you're racing against have energy bars and also have those quirky random little names that come up as you're going through the track. And you can either win the race outright, or you've got much more chance of getting to the end or winning it by punching and kicking people off their bikes, which is a great unique feature at the time.
It is, and there's so many cool things with this. I mean, it was one of the first games I personally had ever seen that had the rolling hills. You know, up until that point, most games, I'm sure there was probably an earlier one out there, but most games were very much, it was just on a flat road and you raced around. So, and it really made a difference. You know, you could, doing the sort of racing and jumping over, sort of landing on a car roof, which I've done just when I was playing the other day. This is the coolest thing ever. So good.
Yeah, it really does a good job of creating that sort of manic element that when you're going so fast and going over a hill unseen and there's a car on the other side and you're scrambling to get out of the way of it, or more often than not, slam into the back of it. And you will go flying hundreds of meters down the track, rolling.
Yeah.
Bikers coming past you, or sometimes over you, to inflict more damage. I mean, it's quite brutal and spectacular, some of the crashes you can actually have on Road Rash for such an early game.
And it's those near misses as well. I mean, it's just such an adrenaline rush when you have that two cars, you know, on either side of the road, and you manage to somehow just turn in between them just perfectly. You're just like, oh, this is such an adrenaline rush to go through. It's a brilliant game. I mean, the other thing I think it did really, really well, you mentioned with the characters, because even the sequels of this game and any other game, really, I don't think they've ever captured where you the truly likable and drivers you want to hate, you know, have characters that you really sort of believe in and feel for. So when you're racing, as you say, you know it's like Natasha, or you know it's Slater, or you know it's the cheating Git Biff who you always will have, you know, he always pretends to be sort of like a clean sportsman and everything, but of course he's always got the bat. You get that cool feature, isn't it, when he swings a bat, or someone swings a bat, you can grab it out the hand, and then you've got it.
And then of course you've got that crooked cop O'Leary.
Yeah,
chasing you constantly.
Well, O'Leary wasn't he the thick one? It was the O'Rourke, wasn't it? He was a snooty cop.
O'Rourke,
he was a snooty one. But the first one, you're only racing around California, but they get there's a lot of variety with the tracks, isn't there? You know, sort of, you've got your Palm Springs, and you've got your sort of desert tracks, and sort of like your, is it Redwood Pines? I can't remember. It's like a forest level, just really cool sort of range of places to race on. One thing that I will note, the music isn't particularly great.
You say that, but it has that authentic early 90s EA music, which is used in a lot of their sports games. I mean, the title music for Road Rash, I couldn't help but think, oh my god, this is EA Hockey. It almost sounds exactly the same. So it has a stamp of what Electronic Arts did to really great effect over and over again in their first big string of early 90s hits, particularly on the Mega Drive. It has that very sort of electronic rocky sound chip, which kind of suits this. So whilst on paper it's not that great of a track, it actually sounds really good for a Mega Drive.
Yeah, and I suppose it's one of those that it's great apart from when you've been playing the game for by an hour. It was like, oh, I've got to switch off the music now. It's really doing my head in.
Yeah, but then
you hear the sound effects.
You've got to listen to that lawnmower engine sound.
Was it a lawnmower? I thought it was like a little mosquito or something.
It was the electronic engine noise. Yeah. It's not the best.
Yeah,
so
it sounds not great.
However annoying it is.
But, I mean, do you know the history with Road Rash and how it nearly was completely a different game?
I guess I don't. Why don't you enlighten us?
Yeah. Well, because I find this fascinating, actually. To begin with the game, you've got Carl May. Now, he worked in Epix on, you know, he did various conversions, possibly the NES conversion of Maniac Mansion.
Okay.
And things like that. But anyway, he did various things. And he when Epix went bust, he went across to work for EA. And he was told to come up with a racing engine for the NES for a game called Andretti Racing, which was like, and he had to do bank roads, because obviously it's Andretti's sort of like NASCAR.
Yeah,
you need
right.
bank roads, which I think he failed at. But in the process, he wrote a really, really solid, fast, with rolling hills, engine that would work very well on more powerful hardware. So they suddenly thought, well, this would be perfect for the Mega Drive. And they were like, okay, we've got this game now. What game are we going to make for it? And this is where you've got Randy Breen step forward. Now, the biggest game that he'd worked on up to that point was 688 Attack Sub, which I don't know if you've ever played.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a hit, but it very much a sort of like, you know, a dry strategy game. You can sort of, it had a fun elements, but it was, you know, it was quite a serious game. Yeah. So of course he was like project lead for it, and he wanted to do basically a true sense motorbike club simulator. And that was it. And he was going to get it like officially licensed by the motorbike society out there and what have you. But of course, part of that was that you'd have to keep at the speed limit. You were rewarded for, you know, just keeping to the speed limit and being a good boy.
Basically.
Really dull. Yeah. And you know, the team knew this. They were secretly calling it behind his back, you know, the Randy's Sunday Drive game. they just didn't like it. But it got as far as being tested, you know, behind closed doors in the Computer Electronics Show in 1990.
Okay.
And everybody hated it. Like, everybody who tested it said, this is just boring, not interested. And EA was ready to pull the plug and just say, right, okay, we tried it. You know, done. But Carl May, you know, obviously it's his engine, and he'd been quite vocal saying that this game isn't going to work. He actually went over Randy's head and said to EA, give me, you know, a couple of months, and they hit on 6 months to salvage the game. Let me turn it into a game that will be fun to play and people will like. And it was Carl that came, it sort of turned it around. He turned it into the illegal racing, the punching, all those elements that is Road Rash. He did. But because Randy was quite powerful within EA and really wasn't happy that he'd gone above his head, he sort of, on the credits, it's got Randy all over it, as the main producer. In fact, any of the ones in the series has Randy. And I think Carl May only has a note as, I forget the exact role, but it's, you know, just perhaps for the game engine. But really, it's Carl's game, in my opinion.
That's quite interesting.
So, yes, I thought it's, you know, it's quite fascinating with it. But, I mean, back to the game itself, it's I love the series, but I do find the first one always charms me. I felt it lost something as it continued on. I mean, have you tried some of the sequels with it?
Yeah, I think connoisseurs of the series tend to suggest, and I would agree, that Road Rash 2 is the superior game. More tracks.
Yeah.
A variation of races and bikes, and I think you've got a chain weapon, which isn't in the first one. Yeah. So it's definitely the superior version. And then after that, it gets a little bit silly, with the exception of the 3DO version, which really took it to another level entirely. You know, that was such a great showcase game for that hardware. And is an absolute stone-cold classic, along with Need for Speed on that console. EA really were pushing the envelope with those two IPs in particular. But back to the Mega Drive stuff, and particularly the first Road Rash, because that was on a lot of different formats and was very popular, wasn't it? It was on the Amiga.
Yeah, well, that's where I first played it, yeah.
Which I find quite incredible. I've never played the Master System on that.
It's a good version, actually.
I can't imagine it's as graphically... as impressive as the Mega Drive.
Yeah, it's not as graphically impressive, but it does a pretty solid job for what it's doing. Really, quite good. No, I mean, for me, I find that the second one, you're absolutely right, because obviously they did it all across America with the second one. That's okay. I just there's something about they make more of the actual characters in the first one. Just with, you know, it seems what they're saying is a bit more sort of frequent.
You're not telling me you're playing it for the plot, are you?
It's not really a plot, but I was, believe it or not, I managed to get it in my head as a teenager playing it on the Amiga. I got it in my head that if I was really, really nice to Natasha, she at the end of the game, she would become your girlfriend.
Very nice. I see what you did there. I pretended I was more of a Mad Max Road Warrior type thing, and I was delivering 150 mile an hour justice to some bad guys, which worked for me just fine.
Yeah. I mean, even today, I mean, I cranked it up on the Mega Drive. I've got all three. I tried all three, and they're still just as good. I mean, the only thing I will say, what you do basically is as you race, you win money, don't you, for coming first, second or third.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to complete the six tracks and then you'll go up a level.
Right.
And that's basically the same tracks but longer and more difficult. You get like tougher cars and things. But what you also can do with that money that you're earning is that you can buy better bikes, which is quite cool. But it does get to the point, in my opinion, that as you get on to a good few levels in and you're on faster bikes, it basically becomes just too darn difficult because you're just going too fast.
When you get that really fast black bike.
Yeah, you just can't.
One, it's so fast that it's almost uncontrollable, as you say. Yeah. So you could look at it that it provides additional challenge, but I think what's supposed to be a reward ends up becoming more of a hazard, unfortunately.
Yeah, or in my case, it just end up rage quitting. which is what happened this week when I was sort of playing it again, because I got very far with it, because it's one of those games that I'll just play again and again. One thing that was disappointing, though, because there was I also tried it on the PSP, because you had the EA Replay.
Right.
It's got the Road Rash. And I put it on and I thought, hello, the music sounds even worse. I don't remember it being this bad. And they've changed the music to one song. For some bizarre reason, there's not the original music on it. So I don't know whether they had sort of legal qualms or whatever with it.
There's nothing that winds me up more as when they re-release an old game and completely change music, particularly something that's very memorable, like...
Yeah.
Or Crazy Taxi or whatever. Oh, it annoys the hell out of me. It spoils the game completely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this, you know, annoyed me on the EA Replay, which is a bit of a lazy collection, to be honest, which is such a shame because there's some real classic games on that EA Replay.
Absolutely. But before we sort of wrap up on Road Rash, one thing that's occurred to me whilst I was sort of thinking about my experiences with this game, old and new, is can you imagine if they sort of went back to the drawing board with Road Rash now and did it with a Burnout style engine, you know, really spectacular crash system and impressive graphics engine stuff? It would be such a massive hit.
Well, they were going to do that, wasn't it? They kept on, you know, with Criterion Software.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to do sort of like a Road Rash. And there's even, if you look, there's they kept on mentioning about it because people have been sort of like jumping up and down for it. And there was also some test footage, if you look, because there was also an EA sanctioned Xbox Live version that they were going to do, and that never got past the drawing board. There is one that's recently come out on Steam. I think it's still in beta. There was a game called Road Redemption that came out on Steam.
Okay.
It seems a really, really good version, but for me, they did the ultimate sin. Certainly on the beta version that I had, which you still pay for, you know, you're still paying full price for. It would only work with an Xbox 360 controller, which I don't have for my PC. I haven't got the rather overpriced cable that lets you do the Wi-Fi for the Xbox 360. But it looked, I mean, I played it on keyboard and it looks a really, it was, even on keyboard, it was quite fun. I just was so peed off, to be honest, that in fact I even sent them a little snotty mail saying, you know, how can you not support other controllers outside of the Xbox 360? That's just like so lazy. Which they replied, yes, I know, but we plan to do it at some point, but it's not going to happen. But yeah, I mean, for those who are fans of the series, that's a really useful tip anyway, if you have an Xbox 360 controller for your PC. Road Redemption, because it is a really good update. But I'm still hoping that, you know, Criterion will do a road rash that deserves to be done, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know, for me, it would be license to print money for EA.
Yeah, it's an intellectual property that demands a modern take on it, absolutely.
Hello, this is Kevin Toms. You're listening to Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast.
Okay, so on to our one out-and-out arcade classic that we're covering on today's episode, Road Blasters. It's a vintage Atari Americana type of game, isn't it?
Yeah, it came out in 1987, which is a lot later than you perhaps realise, actually. It was on that cusp. I suppose it's when you compare it to things like Outrun, it doesn't look as pretty as Outrun that came the year before.
No, not a lot of things do, though, for that period of time.
No. Really. But what a game. I love this game.
Yeah, we won't hold a special guest because it's not that bad looking in its own right. But
yeah,
it's another one of these games where in Road Blasters you just sort of have to finish, don't you, before you run out of fuel.
Yeah.
The kind of clock you're working against.
It's got a really nice arcade balance. So what it is and it... In many ways, it's got terrible handling, but it works for the game. It just works. So basically, you're in a sort of Mad Max kind of like car with guns on the front, and it's from that sort of similar viewpoint of the games like, you know, Pole Position and Outrun and those style games from behind. And the idea is you're racing on the track, but you're not racing other cars. It's that balance between you have to pick up fuel pellets, so you get like green orbs and red orbs, which has more fuel, and that's critical because if you don't pick them up, you'll run out of fuel and you won't complete that round. And then to get the score element, you also have other cars on the road which you must shoot, and you get like a sort of like bonus awards is the speed of how you're shooting them and your accuracy. So, you know, you're not wasting bullets.
It is possible, isn't it, that you can hold the button down and be sort of constantly firing, but you get no score multiplier for that. So if you're in a high score chaser, which most people who played games at this period of time were, you had to play for accuracy. You would always shoot when you thought you could hit something. And that's where the skill element really comes into the game, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's that just that perfect balance. I mean, particularly if you play it in the arcade, it's gorgeous with the cab. If ever you're lucky enough to sort of play it, it really sort of comes together with the controls. But even on the home versions, and a good way to play this, by the way, probably the best way I think is on the Midway Arcade Treasures compilation, which came out on the PS2 and Xbox.
It's weird how the PS2 is such a great retro gaming console because of these compilations that came out.
Yeah, it's a sort of lost thing that, you know, gone are the days where you would get, a massive collection of arcade games. Now they try to sell it digitally, individually, to make more money, and it's such a shame that those days have passed, because there was some, I mean, the one that I mentioned, the Midway Arcade Treasures compilation, has got so many sort of like Atari, because Midway bought out Atari later, so it's a lot of them are Atari, like this classic arcade games. You've really got the creme de la creme. Well, on the first one, and it plays really well. In fact, I started trying to play this on MAME, and you know, found it. I couldn't get the controls quite right because I knew what it was like in the arcades, and I ended up actually when playing this, I ended up cranking up Midway Arcade Treasure. Because it just works so well. They've got the twin sticks, so you've got the twin sticks to turn. I adore this game. It's the purity of it, though. The futuristic settings, and it just gets that perfect balance of progressively harder as you go on, and it almost has that. Although it's very much quick play, it's not the sort of thing you'd spend hours on, because you get the score multipliers and that element of you really become a score junkie with this game, where you're just trying to, and through that you almost get infinite replay, because you're always just know you can get a slightly better score, and just to sort of take you above. And it's got a cool little scenes like I think it was one of the first times I'd sort of seen that, where you have an airplane fly overhead. And it drops the like a turbo boost onto you, isn't it? And you line up the car to sort of collect it. To be honest, it doesn't seem to do much in the game, but it was just things like that would just seem so cool, you know.
Yeah, it's a nice little touch, isn't it? And
yeah,
the game in itself is quite simple in execution, but I wouldn't say it's overly difficult. But like arcade games of its time, it was designed to gobble your money. So if you're not particularly good at memorizing the courses and where certain cars are going to appear or where the
fuels
are going to pop up, it's going to gobble your money pretty quickly, isn't it?
Because exactly, that's one thing I should add, is every time you crash, like you hit a car, or you crash off the track, you obviously lose fuel. I mean, one of the nice things, it doesn't really slow you down that much, but it does make you lose, you know, because it's not really about time.
Yeah, it doesn't break up the gameplay, but your fuel gauge takes a massive hit, so you're going to have to put in an extra 20p or whatever to keep yourself going, which is perfect arcade coin gobbling technique, as it was back in the day.
I had so much fun with this, though. I really did. It was just, I love the old arcade games because they're so pure and central in their vision of what they're trying to do. So for me, I always find that just so refreshing in today's world of gaming, to play something that's just simple and so focused.
And I
had a lot of fun with it. And it's good because it's one that I've sort of played in dribs and drabs, you know, but it was never truly sort of sat down to truly work my way through, spend some serious time with it. But obviously for the podcast, I did, and I was so glad, because it's a real gem. And I even tried some of the home ports, and they're pretty solid.
Because everyone knows the arcade's really good. There were so many different home conversions of this, so there's many formats. So which ones would you recommend for any of our listeners who want to give us a go?
Yeah, well, but obviously I'd say the PS2 is the best way to play the arcade one. Because obviously the arcade is always the best, but probably the Mega Drive version.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really solid version.
So that one was done by Tengen, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean they've got the speed. You know, a lot of the other ports tended to not be quite right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those. A lot of them were pretty solid, to be fair, because it's such a pure game. It's sort of easy to do. As
I was going to say, my primary experience of playing this back in the day, I've tried different ones more recently, but closer to the time, I played this a lot on the Atari Lynx. That was my sort of childhood handheld. Whilst the Lynx didn't have a ton of really top-tier games, Road Blasters was actually pretty good on it. It's a lot slower than the arcade, and probably the Mega Drive one. The scrolling on it isn't quite as rapid as the arcade experience, but it's actually pretty good, surprisingly faithful. And you'd expect it to, because it's a first-party thing, with it being an Atari / Epics design console. So it should be good, and it is. So if you've never played it on Lynx and you have one, I'd definitely recommend you give that a try.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I enjoyed that one. That was good. One thing I will say about it, though, when I was doing research for this game, because I like looking around, I made a discovery which I know is going to cost me money down the line. Mm-hmm. Apparently Matchbox came out with a toy range based on the video game.
Right.
And you can buy, although it's quite expensive in the box, because I couldn't see an unboxed one, but you can buy the Road Blaster Matchbox car for £30. And I really want a loose one, because I'm going to play with it. but I could only find ones in the box. But I really want a Road Blaster car now, because it looks really, really cool.
Okay, if you happen to be frequenting a charity shop and you see a Road Blaster's Matchbox toy car, get in touch with the risk.
Yeah, I'll happily buy it from you.
He will pay you silly amounts of money for it. Or give you a shout out on the podcast, whichever you prefer.
Yeah.
But there was also a competition with the arcade version of this, wasn't there, whereby if you hit a certain high score and you had to get to the very, very end of the game, you could enter your code or send off your code to Atari directly, and they would provide you with a T-shirt, which a competition ran for a few months, which is quite novel.
Yeah, they tried to do cool things like that with Atari, didn't they? It's good. It's nice that they sort of did that. I suppose you can always sort of get to the end, because as long as you're putting in the money.
Yeah, exactly. So you're pretty much buying that T-shirt.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could redeem it today. I wonder who I would write to.
Yes. Yeah, get to the end of the game and say, I want
someone's
my T-shirt.
Someone's still going to be liable for those T-shirt orders.
I'm sure that someone's done like a replica. I'll quite happily get a replica.
Okay, so Drisk needs a Matchbox Road Blaster toy car and a replica T-shirt.
I basically want lots of toys. I've never grown up.
It's the right time of year to be asking for that sort of thing, so get your list of little things to Mrs. Drisk. She might be able to hook you
up. I have to write off to Santa.
Okay, so on to our next game. It's one of my favourite series, back from the PS1 days. It's one of those that I sunk an ungodly amount of time into back in the day, and compared to some of our other suggestions for vehicular combat games, this is one of the ones that is literally all out vehicular warfare. If anything, there's no racing element to it. It's all about the guns, the missiles, the special attacks, the ramming of cars, the carnage that comes with it. We are talking about Twisted Metal.
Yep, well, Twisted Metal 2, isn't it, in particular?
In particular, it's definitely the highlight of the series.
Yeah.
The first one's still definitely worth a go, but the second one, I think, is where the series excelled, particularly from my experience. But for those who may not have played this, and I'm sure there's probably a few of our listeners who haven't given this a try, it's very much a sort of Marmite-type game. You either love it or you hate it. But the premise of the game is that this mysterious character known as Calypso has arranged a vehicular combat tournament whereby the winner gets any wish of his desires granted. So I think Calypso is some sort of super outlaw villain, sort of super villain, whatever, and he has the ability to grant wishes at will. Funny story, very odd to put that into this type of game, but not so important in the overall grand scheme of things.
I didn't bother with the story. I mean, just get straight into
we'll get into it a little bit later, how that particular plot line becomes relevant, but in terms of enjoyment of the game, it's entirely meaningless. It's basically a 3D arena combat game on wheels, and I bloody love it, I'm not going to lie. You face off across a range of different other vehicles. You get to choose which one you want to be, and then there's several others that you'll be competing against. And each character and car has their own individual attributes, such as varying speeds, armor, and firepower, and they all have their own unique individual special attack. which I think is a really nice touch because it adds a lot of variation to the game. I chose the character Spectre a lot of the time when I was playing it because it was a really fast, nippy little sports car, and hence the name Spectre. It could actually shoot a homing missile, which could go through buildings, which is incredibly powerful. So you can pretty much hit someone from anywhere on the map, which was really cool.
And the racer, the driver looked really cool as well with the shades for Spectre.
Well, yeah, that's nothing to do with my choice, but if you like him, that's fine. So eventually, you're fighting through various different parts of Los Angeles in the first game, or in the second game, you're on World Tour, so you're fighting off in different parts of the world. So you start off in LA, and you go to Antarctica, Paris, various other different places. And eventually, in the first one, you face off against an armoured personnel carrier called Minion. It's basically a massive tank. Incredibly difficult to beat. But eventually becomes unlockable, I think, through cheat codes. It's a great fun way to play, but ultimately makes the game far too easy. But if you just want to mash around in the 3D environment, then it's pretty cool. But for me, it's the combination of varying car uniqueness and the characters attached to each vehicle, which really provide this with tons of different variation and replayability compared to a lot of games of this type, which tend to be quite repetitive due to using one car a lot of the time. But in Twisted Metal 1, the game, say, it's limited to LA. Most of the stages kind of blend together. They're kind of grey and black and gritty. And it's fair to say that even for a first year of the PlayStation, it's not that aesthetically pleasing. It certainly hasn't aged as gracefully as something like Wipeout that we spoke about earlier. But that said, it got very mixed reviews on its release, but Electronic Gaming Monthly, which is one of the big magazines out in the States, gave this its Game of the Year for 1995, which is quite remarkable.
It is, really, yeah.
It's a mark of how passionate that a certain element of the PlayStation's fan base really felt about the game and the series in general. But as you've been playtesting, Drisk, it really peaks with Twisted Metal 2, doesn't it? So why don't you tell us about your experience with that game?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, this is actually one series I've never actually played. Passed me by back in the day, and well, when I started playing it, I was sending you messages like, why have you chosen this? This is all awful. It's so dull, because it was like the opening level. It was it's a massive track, and because I perhaps didn't actually bother to read any instructions, or listening to any backstory, I went straight into it. So I was thinking it was some kind of racing game. Shooting elements. So my initial thought, this is just terrible. I'm racing around, nothing's happening.
If you stick to the track, you're going to miss a lot of the action, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I was going off the track and thinking, I just thought it was too wide an area. I didn't know where anybody was. They were just like whizzing past me. And then I discovered that you had things like the ability, the handbrake and that to do sharp turns. So you can easily turn round, and also discovered that you can sort of, understanding that you've got like a map that tells you where the other cars are, and sort of understanding what all those coloured dots meant, and which one was the cars. Once I clicked with that, I did have fun with it. I did have a lot of fun with it once I got to that point. Although I did find it's one of those games I can imagine works so well with other human players, but against computers, you just haven't got that satisfaction, really.
Yeah, it's a perfect two-player game, because particularly with Twisted Metal 2, it adds a two-player co-op. So you can imagine the banter that you would have as you're slamming around, crashing into things, and you're throwing various power-ups around, particularly the ricochet bombs, which I think are a really crazy perk of this game. So I don't know if you picked them up whilst you were playing it, but basically... Yeah. You're in a 3D arena, even if the map likes to indicate that it's an open world experience. You basically have invisible walls, so you can only go so far. And these ricochet bombs, literally, like you think, they are round circular bombs, and they bounce off walls until they hit something. And you can get quite a few of these appearing on the map simultaneously, which cause absolute mayhem, particularly in the smaller maps. But they're so funny.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of dark comedy in with the plot of this, but some of the weapons are just so over the top. I still really like it even to this day. One of the aspects I really like about Twisted Metal 2, the World Tour, is the destructible scenery in it, which really opens up a lot of really cool secret areas and adds variation to the arenas.
That's one thing I liked, actually, how you did find sort of like hidden health and things like that. You know, it's one of those, again, if you take the time to learn the track, I can imagine against other human players particularly, it becomes really satisfying sort of doing all of that. I also liked, you know, I think it was just a boss, wasn't it? But the Sweet Tooth.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that was, it's like an ice cream truck with the demonic clown. Mm-hmm. And it plays that really creepy ice cream music as it comes round the corner.
There's a lot of dark comedy in the game, and I think Sweet Tooth became a sort of staple central character for the series as it progressed further. Yeah. I don't think it intended to be at first, but it certainly ends up going that way as the series progresses and gets further and further into it.
And
but did you have any particular character or car that you enjoyed the most?
Yeah, to be honest, I went for Spectre as well.
Yeah,
yeah, really I did cool the same one.
Little touch. I like Axel as well in Twisted Metal 2, which is basically he's two giant sort of monster truck wheels, and he's a dude whose arms are attached to both wheels. He is the axle. It's a human axle. It's absolutely crazy. Such a weird way to put a character into a game.
Yeah, going back to you were saying about with the Sweet Tooth, I was reading up on the internet, and apparently there's an ice cream truck company called Frosty Treats attempted to sue because they had a clown logo. Clear and a similar sort of design to the ice cream truck, and you know, it was felt that what they'd done is take that idea of of the psycho of the cute clown that they had for Frosty Treats and sort of made a demonic apocalyptic version, which I thought was quite cool. But actually, one thing I didn't realize with this as well, did you know it's a David Jaffe game? You know, he of God of War's fame.
I didn't realize
that. It's one of his games. I can imagine, particularly back in the day, playing it, and particularly, I mean, could you play, was it just two players, or could you go, was there like a multi-tap for the PS2?
No, I don't think it was multi-tap compatible, but you could have two players playing against computer, multiple cars in the arena, or you could play two-player co-op, which is really good fun.
I can imagine that being a lot of fun. I'd love to play, you know, wider sort of like
I wish this game had been around during the sort of internet era.
Well, I saw there was a PS3 version.
Yeah, it's called Twisted Metal Black, and I don't know why, but it just didn't ring out to me. I had a PS3 when that came out, and I just didn't touch base with it, unfortunately.
One that I did find an awful lot of fun, because to be honest, when I got a bit bolshy when I was sort of playing this initially, I thought, there's got to be... So I was looking through other games of similar ilk to see if I could try and woo you into choosing a different game.
No chance.
until it clicked, and you've got to try, honestly. It was Paul Davis that made me realize with this game. He said you've got to try Rogue Trip Vacation 2012. It's done by the same team, but it was like after, you know, when they got independent.
What system is that on?
It's PS1 still. Mm-hmm. It is so good. It's basically Twisted Metal, but even more insane. So, honestly, you've got to give it a try. There's another element. One of the iconic vehicles, to give you an idea how crazy it is, it's called the Meat Wagon.
Okay.
And it's a hot dog truck, with a big hot dog. And as well as like firing the weapons as you can normally, you actually can sort of fire out your big hot dog sausage.
I was going to say, fire out your big sausage.
Yeah, fire out your big sausage. And you actually wave your sausage around and fight the other. It's just hilarious. It's really, really good. And it's got a really, really good soundtrack with this one as well.
Sounds like it could be called Paul and the Prison Years.
And another cool thing they add to this, this came out in 1998, this Road Trip Vacation. One of the things that's quite cool, they mix in elements of Crazy Taxi. So you have like a tourist that's in the map somewhere. So it'd be like a crazy alien character or you know, it's a guy dressed like Superman or whatever. And you actually pick him up. But the other cars are trying to eject because you gain money and you have to take them to like scenic photo points basically on the map. Mm-hmm. And park the car briefly so they can, and that's how you sort of like earn money as well. So it's a whole, so as well as destroying all the vehicles as you do in the Twisted Metal games, you've got that whole Crazy Taxi element as well, where you're sort of fighting over, I suppose, a bit like Chase the Flag kind of death, you know, that you're having death matches and what have you.
Right.
But it's, yeah, really, really good fun. And I think that would have passed a lot of people by because obviously 1998 was quite late in the PS1 period.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never heard of that one, but it's, if you're a Twisted Metal fan, that sounds like something that you would want to give some time to.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I did come around with this one. I mean, we have to include it. It's clearly, when you look at any list, it's people's, one of their most go-to favourites when they mention vehicular.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident combat. That when people get hold of this podcast, they'll get it a little bit excited when they realise that we're talking about Twisted Metal, even if it's just for nostalgia. Because I think it's one of those ones that people who enjoyed at the time still hold a very significant feeling for, even today. I think, in fairness to you, Drisk, these games are probably a bit trickier to get into with fresh eyes, but anyone who enjoyed them at the time will still love them as much today as they did back then. You know, they're really simple to get into. They reward you for investing a lot of hours in there because there's so many different variable endings for every character. So if you want to get the whole overall story of what's going on in Twisted Metal, you have to finish it with every character in there to get a full idea of what's going on. And it's a really good multiplayer game. And most people's favourite games of all time are usually multiplayer orientated, and this one is no different. For me, it's an all-time PS1 classic. There's absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever.
Well, I suppose the reason I didn't sort of play it is because I was on PC land and probably playing the game we're going to talk about next.
Well, that was an excellent segue. I appreciate you doing that for me. So I think everyone remembers the first time they played Carmageddon. It was one of the most impressive games at first glance I can ever remember playing. Did you play it when it very first came out?
I did, yeah. Yeah, it was huge at the time.
It really was.
And it was particularly good because you had all the, you know, the multiplayer elements as well that came certainly with the Splat Pack version.
Yes.
But yeah, it was a really good, solid engine for the time. It looked really impressive.
I thought it was incredible. I thought I was playing something from the planet when I played this. But bear in mind that very shortly before this came out, Psygnosis had released Destruction Derby to critical acclaim. Mm. And that was a very good game in its own right, no doubt about it. Very worthy of all the praise that it got. But that was a game whereby the engine prevented your car from ever leaving the ground, even an inch, no matter how hard it got hit.
Yeah.
Whereas Carmageddon took the physics, the graphics, the violence, and took it to multiple notches further up the chain. I mean, it was visually very impressive.
Oh, definitely.
When it first came out. And then once they released the 3D accelerator patch, it really looked absolutely stunning, didn't it?
Definitely. I mean, should we just explain the game to those who perhaps haven't played it? Because it might have passed a lot of people by. Basically, Carmageddon, it's another futuristic sort of Mad Max-style racer where the thing that it really was famous for is there was three ways of completing the game. There was the boring way, which was almost like a racing game where you just have to pass all the checkpoints on the map. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was running over every single person on the track, because you have all these little people, and there's not a single stereotype that's left untouched with this. I mean, you've got everything from little grannies with Zimmer frames to bikini clad women to even monks. I think on the Splatback, at least.
Sports jocks and cows,
businessmen
everywhere.
I mean, it's just every stereotype you can imagine, and it's and to be honest, it is a although it's rather macabre, it's a lot of fun, because they're all running around screaming, and you actually not only get points for running them down, but you also get style points. So if you sort of like spin the car into them, or you get multiple hits in one go, you'll get extra sort of like credits.
Yeah, and then you spend that cash on upgrading the car.
Yeah, or one of the things I like as well is if you crash the car, then it's just basically pressing on the PC, at least. You press a keyboard, I think it was R or whatever you defined it as, and it would basically flip over the car on your back. And it'd be the same for, you'd see sort of like damage to your car as you crash up, and you can just repair on the fly. You can do it in the game. It just doesn't, you know, stop you. And it's so easy to get the money back. So it's very much one of those, you can just drive around and have fun. But of course, really, I mean, the way to play this game is you have to knock all the other opponents and destroy them, really. So it's very much like Twisted Metal, like that, because to be honest, yes, you can complete the tracks by reaching all the checkpoints, but that's rather dull. But the idea of running down every single person on the map, it would take you forever. Because you imagine,
particularly some of them, because
they're all hidden away and stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the cool things about this game, is that you can play quite linearly, so just following the track around A to B, finish the race, or you can do the other two methods, which is hunt down all the other opponents, destroy their cars, or go after the pedestrians. Now, the maps on this are so open world and big. That could actually take a really long time.
Oh, it is, yeah.
But there are upgrades that you can get to assist in that. You can get like a radar upgrade, which shows you where all the people are on the map, not just your opponents, but the cities. Yeah. And then you can also get a lightning upgrade, which means if you pass even just within a few meter proximity of someone, they get zapped by an electric ray out of your car, which is quite spectacular when you go through a large group of them at the same time.
And it is. It's just, it reminds me a bit like South Park, in that it's just no holds barred. And also, as you like run into the people, they're not just like disappearing. They're like split into 1,000 pieces over the bonnet.
Yeah, really gross. Fire.
Yeah. It's it is. It makes you evilly chuckle as you're racing through. And the other thing I really like with it, actually, is certainly on the PC version, but I realise on the PlayStation version you didn't have this.
I'm going to pretend the PlayStation one doesn't exist for the purpose of this exercise.
Yeah. Well, the N64 one, I'm definitely going to say is not going to exist. I mean, with the zombies and... Oh, that was such a bad version. Anyway, the PC versions are really the only one to play. One of the things I love, and it still impresses me today, you actually have sort of full motion video recording of you. So you can play two characters. So there's Max Damage, who's the guy, or you can play as Diana.
Yeah, and they put a lot of thought into that, didn't they?
Oh, I think it's perfectly in keeping. And it's just great seeing the expression, because it's an actual actor and actress that have been filmed. And they're perfectly sort of like cast. And then just seeing them as you like spin the car or do a jump, scream out. And they're also speak throughout it all as well. And it just made me laugh that one point, it made my daughter laugh as well, actually. Because she was watching me play this game and thinking, why are you being so sick, Dad, playing this game? And anyway, I did this crash when I went flying off, and I said, "Oh shit!" at the exact same time as the computer said, "Oh shit!" And it just sort of tickled me. It was like exactly in tandem. But it's just great seeing the expressions and the evil looks, and even little touches that look behind them as you reverse. And you get the two viewpoints as well, which is really cool. So you can do it from behind, or you can do in cockpit. Yeah. And it amazes me, though, that with this game, that because it's done by Stainless Games developer. Mm-hmm. And first thing amazes me that it was done in Isle of Wight, the developer team, in Newport, in the Isle of Wight. So, you'd think with this sort of, like, grotesque, sort of over-the-top Americana-type game that you'd be done somewhere in America.
Yes, it's definitely got that dystopian LA vibe about it.
Yeah, and it's one of the games you might have played, one of the guys who coded this and co-founded the Stainless Games, he went off to do State of Emergency, which an average game, but it's similar sort of over-the-top sort of style, no holds barred. But I love the backstory with this game as well. I don't know if you know the backstory, Matt. But,
no.
But basically, they had a bit of development hell that in turn, I think, really turned this in, made it the special game that it was, because it took a while for them to work on it. Because they started off, they're trying to do like a Destruction Derby style game.
Yeah.
So it's just going to be like, you know, almost like Destruction Derby and the PlayStation, that style.
Just a smash-em-up.
Yeah, smash-em-up. Mm-hmm. And then they managed to secure, for a time, the license for Mad Max. So that's when they started to try going more open world and all the futuristic elements. And then, for whatever reason, that license fell through. So they were like, oh my God, you know, what we're going to do? We need to find another license. And they decided on, there was a comic at the time, a very sort of underground comic called Death Chase 2020, which is, of course, like a sequel to the film Death Chase 2000. So they thought, well, that's a great way. We'll pick up that license for the comic and we'll do a Death Chase 2020. And they were working on that. And then quite late in the day, that license fell through as well. So in the end, they just decided, well, let's do our own thing. And then, you know, that's where they did Carmageddon. But I'm sort of glad it went through that development hell of those licenses falling through, because I think that's what makes this so unique, with all these different elements of running over people, because obviously that would come from Death Chase. You had the points and that element. You've got the futuristic element that, the gritty, grimy, futuristic element of and the open worlds that you get with Mad Max, and of course you got the Destruction Derby elements. So you know, I really feel it helped evolve this to a really special game.
Yeah, that's a very cool story, and it gives you a good indicator of how it got to what it eventually became, which is very interesting. But let's talk very briefly about some of the power-ups in this, because it's all well and good being able to smash into people at high speed, but some of the power-ups you can pick up in this really add a lot of comedic value and add some spectacular smashes into the mix.
Yeah.
So we've already talked about the Electro Ray.
Yeah.
Which you can pick up for naming civilians. How about some of the cool features that you pick up for the car, like pinball mode?
Yes.
Which basically, whenever you touch a piece of scenery on another car, it sends them and you flying spectacularly far away, which can be across the ground or up in the air. And sometimes you can hit people at such high speed in pinball mode that you flip up into the sky, and I mean literally like miles into the sky, and you can be stuck in what seems like an infinite amount of flips, and you can just hear your mum going, ooh, ooh, and it come down about 5 minutes later. It's absolutely insane, but absolutely hilarious to actually watch and participate in. And then you have the granite car, which is truly monstrous. So basically it turns your car into a wrecking ball. So anything you touch just instantly dies.
Yeah.
Just turns into an absolute heap. So if you ram someone at a reasonable speed, their car will just get totaled immediately, which is absolutely superb.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's just so many fun elements to this game. Again, a bit like the Twisted Metal, I think it's one that works better, you know, with the network play and that element. I'd love to try and do that again. Try and set that up. Because you can, of course, play this game, GOG.com, giving them a shout out again. But I imagine it's probably also on Steam. And one of the things they sell is the Splat Pack, which is well worth it because that's the first game. Plus it was like a data disc, wasn't it, with extra tracks, extra cars, and it really adds a lot to the game, the Splat Pack. And I've got it on GOG, and it really plays it very well. Plus you get the Windows version and the DOS version. The Windows version was slightly touched up, slightly graphically. And it had various other options as well, which is, so it's no excuse really. It's quite, if you've got a PC, it's quite easy to
I actually played this again very recently on iOS. Mm-hmm. They released it, I think, a year or 18 months or so ago on the Apple Store. Because Stainless were doing a Kickstarter for a new Carmageddon game, which I coincidentally backed. But I played this on my iPad. I thought, oh, I'd really love to play Carmageddon again on something convenient like an iPad, and did. And I thought, oh, this is going to be really difficult with touch controls.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty much the same as playing it on a keyboard, which a lot of people would have had to do back in the day.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have thought it would work.
Okay. I absolutely loved it. It was superb fun. I went through the whole thing. It was great.
Because I'm surprised. I just didn't think it would work with touch screen.
No, it's tricky to get used to, but then again, it was pretty hard at the time playing it on a keyboard.
Mm.
So if you can master playing that on the PC via the keys, there's no reason why you can't play the iOS version, and I presume there's the same for the Android as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that frustrated me when because I cranked up the PC version, and that certainly on the Splat Pack it had the joystick support, but I just couldn't. I tried several joysticks, and I just couldn't get it to. It would register, but it was like it was choosing random options, you know, random directions when you're trying to calibrate it. So yeah, I just couldn't get it working. So I had to play it by keys, which, to be fair, that's how I used to play it back in the day. I had a lot of fun with this. The sequel is very good as well, which is Carpocalypse Now, Carmageddon 2.
Yeah, we don't really want to mention the next one, though, which was the Death Race 2000, which I think is quite...
Yeah.
Often regarded as one of the worst sequels ever made, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it is a real shame. Has the Kickstarter one, did that come out in the end? Because I've lost sight of it.
You know, I still get updates sent to me about that now, and I've just stopped reading them because it's been going on for so long. But I'm pretty sure it's on Steam now in some sort of capacity, but I just haven't gotten around to playing it yet.
Yeah. That's a sort of shame, but
I had a massive sense of enthusiasm when the project first started, but it's taken so long I've just lost it now.
Yeah, I've become a bit burned with Kickstarter, I have to say. There's just too much going on.
But back to Carmageddon. Now, one thing that we haven't really touched upon is how good the map design is on this. There are some really cool stages in which you do combat on this. Like, for instance, the first map seems fairly straightforward, but then when you're about three quarters of the way through, there's an option to veer off course to the left slightly, and you wind up in an American football stadium.
Yeah.
And you're able to actually mow down two full sides of American football teams to get massive bonus points and cash, which, you know, sets up the tone of the game pretty well. And then I think it might be the second track, whereby you start almost straight away on a downward hill. And as soon as you gather speed, you basically drift off the hill because it's so vertical down. And at the bottom is a massive herd of cows that you pretty much are guaranteed to splat into at very high speed.
Oh, I love the animals in it. It's just you get like the cute little like boars and goats, and they're like bleating away as you try and evilly run them down. It's it really does bring out your evil side. You realise that actually you know how evil you can be.
Sadism in it in some degree.
But it has that. It's all got, although it's digitised sprites, it's done in such a way where it's very cartoony as well, isn't it? Where you don't feel it's too grotesque.
It's not overly realistic. So yeah. You do get that degree of separation from it where you don't feel bad about what you're actually doing in the game. But interestingly enough, that's where the censors would disagree, because, of course, Carmageddon had a lot of trouble getting through censorship on its release, particularly in the UK and certain other territories.
Mm.
I think in the initial box versions of the game, you were running over zombies, not civilians, and the blood was green rather than red,
yeah.
Which is pretty lame. And eventually they got that overturned with the censorship board, and it is the game as we know it today, which is an extreme gore fest. And absolutely wonderful.
Apart from on the N64, where they did the zombies.
Nintendo, and they'll do things their way. And that is probably the worst version.
It's such
of this
a
game
bad, bad version.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
such a bad version. Yeah, so no, don't play the N64 version. Ignore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretend it never happened.
Indeed. So, on the whole, the original version of Carmageddon, though, is still one of my favourite PC games, even to this day, right from the blood and gore to the Burnout-style massive crashes and smashes. And it also has a really cool soundtrack by Fear Factory, which I don't know if that's a band that you're familiar with, but they're quite a cutting-edge metal band in the mid-90s. They had a very sort of mechanical sound to their art, let's say, and a lot of their sort of album artwork was very sort of H.R. Geiger-esque, you know, sort of biomechanical type stuff, and it really sort of works with this game. And they've got two tracks on this game called Zero Signal, which is the title anthem, and Body Hammer from Fear Factory's very popular album called Demanufacture. So if you're into that sort of thing, this is definitely going to be up your street 100%.
Yeah, definitely. No, I agree. It's a great game. It's quite easy to sort of pick up and play. So, you know, particularly if you've got a PC.
Yeah, an absolute must, and dead easy and cheap to get hold of these days. Now, before we wrap up the show, I think we've got a couple of ones that didn't quite make it off the cutting room floor, some honourable mentions that we'd both like to go through for this genre that we think are worthy of your attention.
Yeah, well, I mean, we wanted this one to be, well, it's not turning out to be as short as we thought, but because we've been nattering away, but it's we wanted to sort of not cover too many games, and therefore some had to go on the cutting room floor. One of the games I want to shout out actually is Auto Jewel, released in 1985. Have you ever played that at all?
No, this is a new one on me.
Yeah, so this is a real gem. I think it came out on, certainly on some of the 8-bits. It certainly came out on the Amiga. That was the one that I remember playing it. And it's done by Lord British, you know, the Richard Garriott of Ultima fame.
Excellent.
And for those who don't know, it's basically, it's based on Car Wars, which is the Stephen Jackson Games Workshop style board game that sort of came out. It's sort of using that world, and it's basically an open world where it's basically like Mad Max, where you're driving around in a futuristic world and you're worrying about fuel. Very, very basic graphics. I mean, if you look at it's not Amiga graphics. It's very much from the 8-bit days. But like any Richard Garriott game, there's just so much depth to the world that you're racing in, and it's one that I think would do very, very well. I'd love to see like a reimagined version of this game done by like Rockstar or somebody like that, because I think there's so many sort of cool elements in this, so well worth tracking that one down. I tried to woo you, didn't I, with Supercars on the Amiga, but you didn't like the look of it. I think it's one that perhaps you needed to have an Amiga back in the day and sort of playing, but fellow Amiga owners such as myself will have very, very fond memories of Supercars. And although it was a basic racing game and overhead, and you would sort of you could fire weapons forward and back and take out the opponents, particularly fun in two player. It's basically like an update to something like Super Sprint and things like that. But one to play on the consoles was very similar ilk. Have you ever played Rock and Roll Racing?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really good. I mean, we sort of put that on the cutting room floor because, to be honest, it's been covered quite a few times by our fellow podcasts out there. I know Retro Game Squad and RGDS have covered that game before, so we didn't want to go through it again.
Yeah, I think that one's been done to death. But yeah. Rightly so, it's a very good game.
There's so many, isn't it? I mean, the other ones you want to shout out? Or
yeah, just one in particular which came very close to me, including in the ones mm-hmm. that I was particularly keen to discuss, but I thought I'd leave it because, purely because it didn't have a good home version. It was an arcade only one.
Yeah.
And there's a game by Namco called Cyber Sled.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever played this.
No, I don't remember that one.
It came out on the PS1. It was close to launch. Mm. And it didn't quite work because back when the PS1 first came out, it didn't have DualShock, so dual analog sticks, which this game really needs. In the arcade, you have twin sticks,
mm-hmm.
and you're in a very polygon-rich 3D combat environment, and you have, they're called sleds, but they're pretty much like small tanks,
mm-hmm.
and you're basically maneuvering around these 3D arenas using various blocks and stuff to cover, and you'd have these really cool sort of chain guns and rockets. And it was just like a one-on-one tank game.
So it's like Battle Zone, like an update of Battle Zone.
Yeah, a little bit like
two-player, but you could do two-player. Or
yeah, but it was a very simple or simplified version of something like World of Tanks is today, but on a much smaller scale. And I absolutely loved it in the arcade. I put a fair few £1 coins into that one back in the day. But yeah, it didn't get a good home version, so I didn't think it's something fair to include because I don't think any of our listeners would have won, either tried it, or if they had it, wouldn't have been very good. But it's an arcade game, it was absolutely super.
And there's some very good arcade, I mean, ones I'm thinking of as well that people won't have heard of, probably. Sega did AB Cop, which is like it's like Chase HQ, but you're on a jet bike. That was pretty cool.
Right.
That's well worth playing. If you can imagine like Chase HQ but set in the future on a jet bike, I think that tells you everything you need to know, and you're much crazier enemies you're almost taking out monsters instead of just a simple car. So it's one that passed a lot of people by. And also, have you ever played Lucky and Wild?
No.
This is one that I always wanted to play in the arcade because you just can't emulate it properly. But it was such a cool idea. It was basically Chase HQ, but in the cockpit. The real draw with this game is it actually had light guns as well.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
So you've got, well, I think it was more like the Operation Wolf style light gun, so really a joystick, but you know, with the gun, but it was really really cool in that you can drive one-handed and shoot and also have a second player who's shooting as well, so it's just a great sort of combination. It's just so sad that you can't really emulate it particularly well with the light gun as well, obviously, in the home, which is why
that sounds tricky. The next time you're in Coral Island or something,
I always look out for it. It's a very rare one, I think. I'd love to hear from any of our listeners that have been lucky enough to play it, but it's gorgeous. I suppose the other one, just to quickly mention, of course, Vigilante 8 is another big series, but it's,
I love that one, Interstate 76 and all that jazz.
And last one is Badlands as well. I jotted down, which is like a futuristic version of Super Sprint done by Atari. I think it appears on probably that Midway Arcade Treasures as well. It certainly appears on one of them. It's not the best Super Sprint clone, but it's nice, you know, set in the future. You can do multiple, you know, so you've got the little cars racing around the track, shooting one another. You know, it has that very much Mad Max vibe. So it's fun, but it's not a classic, I would say.
Fair enough. Now, just before we wrap things up, We've got a couple of mentions on Twitter, so I thought we'd give a shout-out to a couple of people who responded to the news that we were doing Vehicular Warfare this evening. Brooker411, who's a good friend of mine, we work on another podcast, he was very excited about us getting into this one. He mentioned that he got to play a few rounds with David Jaff when Twisted Metal 3 was released.
Wow.
And that... Twisted Metal pretty much sums up his younger days, so yeah. He got a lot of play out of that one, which is really cool. Tom Whitaker said he used to play Carmageddon a lot out in, on Gardenland. Not sure what he's referring to there, but good for you, mate. Sounds like a pretty good time. Play Carmageddon in the garden on a LAN network, why not? So yeah, I think there's a little something for everyone in this episode. I hope it's jogged a few memories for you, and hopefully, unlike us, you won't go out and spend a small fortune reliving those memories, as we often tend to do after we've done one of these episodes. But just want to thank you all for downloading the podcast and supporting us over the last few weeks. We've really put out a lot of cool episodes lately, and we hope to bring you lots more before the end of the year.
Yeah, we've got some cool ideas, haven't we, lined up, which we're itching to share with you.
Including the return of one of our biggest ever episodes.
Yes, well, we've already...
in the very near future.
Well, I think we can say now, hasn't it? Because we've sort of... It's been tweeted out, so it's... Yeah, so we're having the return of the 8-bit special. So we'll see how well Steve will do this time.
And if Spectrum doesn't win everything, I'm going to eat my hat.
It's because Dean, he's got the gift of the gab, you see.
Well, I'm looking forward to
it. I'm a Spectrum lover, and I was like, how did Spectrum win?
purely as a fan, I'm going to enjoy listening to that one. And because I didn't have a C64 or an Amstrad as a kid, I will use it as a bit of education as well as entertainment, but I'm sure you'll all be licking your lips over the possibility of listening to that one in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be awesome.
Okay, so as is tradition on Retro Sound, we're going to play you out with some music from one of the games we've covered tonight. Thanks again for joining us, and we hope to hear and see you again very soon. Good night.
Keep it retro. See ya.
This was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.